Good morning, everybody. Welcome back again to Solomon on Blast, where we're here to address the confusion of our modern culture with the ancient wisdom of Solomon. For those of you who are not big football fans, it is Super Bowl weekend, although you might not be interested. There are millions of people that are, and I'm sure a lot of them would love to be able to go to the game. You want tickets, right? Well, sorry, we don't have any here. But with the price of a single ticket starting around $5,000 and going up to $25,000 a seat, you definitely want to make sure the money you're putting on the table results in a real ticket that has equal value. Because every year there are stories of people spending lots of money to buy a ticket, travel to the game, hotel costs, and everything else that's associated with it, to wind up at the game finding out the ticket they bought was counterfeit. They're fakes. So where would you go? Craigslist, probably not. Actually, StubHub is probably your best bet. It's the nation's largest ticket reseller, and they go to great lengths to make sure the tickets they resell aren't counterfeit. The NFL employs a slew of security features on the tickets themselves, almost as elaborate as the government does for printing U.S. currency, just to reduce the chance of counterfeiting. And StubHub has a whole team of inspectors checking those tickets that come in to ensure they're real before they're placed on the website. Some of the things that the ticket has in place, there's a hologram that shows the San Francisco skyline on the back of the Super Bowl 50 ticket that ensures that it's valid. Under a black light, they can check for a rectangle at the top of the ticket, which is invisible in regular light. And then there's another area below the hologram that they shine a black light on, and that has bright pink 50s and Super Bowls that appear on top of the text. And finally, there's a seemingly innocuous image of the Lombardi Trophy in the front of the numbers 5 and 0. And they check all these things out. In addition, there's a heat-sensitive ink on the tickets this year. He says where you can basically you rub your finger across the image and it disappears and then slowly reappears. And it takes less than 4 seconds for that to happen. So once all these security features are checked out by StubHub, then they also look at things like the laser engraving that's on these tickets. Obvious things that you can just touch and feel and see. And, of course, there's a barcode on the bottom of every ticket now. These are available on these tickets also. That's used to ensure the number matches what's on the ticket. And the big thing that they do is they change the color of the ticket every year. And because this is the 50th anniversary of the Super Bowl, they've actually got gold tickets for the golden anniversary. And StubHub has a whole team of ticket analyzers that basically go through these tickets as they come in before they accept them to put up on their website for sale. And these guys have years and years of experience with these tickets, so they can do a pretty good job of checking them out and determining whether or not they're counterfeit. They carefully log these tickets. They put them in individual packets so that the ink doesn't get smeared on them. And they have armed guards, plainclothes guards all around the office to make sure nothing goes missing. And at the end of each day, they have 4 StubHub staffers that walk the tickets down to a loading dock accompanied by 2 armed guards. And then they're driven in an armored car to an undisclosed location known only to about 6 people, where they're locked in the vault for the night. And this inventory gets sold on StubHub's website. And since they've been doing this, no counterfeit tickets have ever gotten through the StubHub system. But that isn't always the case with everything in life. A lot of things can be counterfeited and get through in life. And, you know, security, all these anti-counterfeiting techniques, the people, the expertise, the expenditures, everything, all just to make sure tickets for a football game are real. And the question is why? What is it about a deception like counterfeiting or any kind of deception that is so egregious that these kind of measures are taken? It's one of the questions we want to address today, because even Solomon, in his wisdom, understood this kind of behavior is more than just simple stealing. Solomon says in Proverbs 20:23, unequal weights are an abomination to the Lord, and false scales are not good. And he makes reference to this in a couple other places as well. So why is it that unequal weights are so detestable? That's what we'll look at when we come back from these commercial breaks. Don't it hurt so bad and lonesome? All right, we're back with more Solomon on Blast. Seems like the music just kind of died there. Anyways, the question is, why is it that unequal weights are an abomination to the Lord, according to Solomon? Why is it that deception is really so egregious in terms of its impact on people? Because when you look at when he says unequal weights, what is he really talking about? He's talking about the weights back in ancient times that they used to measure out different types of goods when they bought and sold things. They had specific standards that were in place, specific weights that were used to balance out whatever it was you were weighing. And if you had unequal sets of weights, maybe one bag had a set of weights that were all accurate and agreed upon, and another one allowed you to cheat somebody, that's really what he's referring to here. So I think when you look at that aspect of it, you see that there's a deception involved, obviously. And I think that may be the real key to why it is so considered such a so detestable, I think, Fred.
Exactly. What we're talking about here is not, as you pointed out, just getting over on somebody, but you're actually changing the entire perception of reality. There's a propaganda element to having false scales. It's beyond just making a quicker or a faster buck or gaining some kind of leverage in a business deal. You are creating, a lie. You're living and you're expressing a lie, and it goes into a completely different dimension than just, again, trying to gain some kind of quick advantage over somebody with money.
So I was wondering if in a robbery or a burglary, you really have no control over that situation. You're gone. You're not there. Somebody just come up and they steal, whether it's through, a robbery face to face. There's typically some level of violence involved. You don't have a whole lot of choice in the matter. It's not like you decided that this is the transaction that I want to get into. Whereas when it is a deception, you're actively participating in this. You've made a decision to transact this business. And I think in some cases, it goes back to the feeling of a personal obligation. Hey, I should have known better. But that's the whole point of a deception, is you don't know.
Let me put it this way. It's like somebody is not just stealing from you something of worth, like money or material good. It's like stealing part of your soul, too. There's something like getting ripped off that's different than just, noticing something is missing. When I was in England years ago, I took my daughter with me. I had business there, and so we were passing through. And we went to see one of those shows in Leicester Square. And I was as green, I did fall off the turnip truck, according to this guy. Anyway, what it is they have if you buy a ticket for a show that's not full on the last day, you're supposed to get half price.
Okay.
And so, I didn't know that. And, I was standing in line, by the ticket window, and somebody pulled me aside and said, "Hey, you're looking for tickets? I got one just for you." And anyway, to make a long story short, he sold me two tickets at the full price, and he told me that, if I stood there, they're going to charge me double. So I listened to him, bought the tickets, and then I realized the next day that I had been burned, And I tell you, there's something about being deceived that is different. Now, this is crazy when I think about it, but I actually went back to Leicester Square the next day looking for this guy just to confront him. I don't know. That right. probably wasn't really wise being in another country and doing that. But the feeling of getting ripped off is different. That's my point.
I agree. There's some difference between...
He lied to me. Yeah. He looked me in the eye and said, this is the case, and I bought it.
Yeah. And there is a little bit of pride maybe involved in that I should have been smarter. And I think that's where the deception part of it really comes into play. But you know, having unequal weights can have a lot of impact when you go into any kind of transaction or a lot of different environments within our lives. If you were to go to the gas station and find out, you know, you pumped and got charged $5 a gallon for gas. Okay, gas is down a lot less, but $3 a gallon, whatever. And you find out you really didn't get a gallon each time. You got ripped off, right? You're going to feel there's that kind of thing going to the grocery stores, those scales there. You expect them to be accurate. There's an expectation that physical weights and measures are immutable, right? The pound is a pound. A liter is a liter. Those things are immutable. They don't change. And so when that deception comes in, you feel like you said, you get ripped off for some reason, or definitely for a reason. And there was another example of this unequal weight or measures, unequal weights and measures. And that was, if you remember, there was the Mars orbiter back in the 90s that got lost because of a difference between the U.S. measurement system and a metric system within the software. That cost NASA $125 million, and all the work and the time that all those engineers put in was for naught just because of these unequal measures. The simple fact that somebody did one thing in one measurement and somebody did a piece of software in a different measurement, the two didn't match up, significant loss. And I think that's kind of what you see in life when those balances aren't...
Yeah, and I think kind of pan back in a philosophical sense. I think honest weights help maintain social order.
It's so
fundamentally, this is what justice is all about, right? That's why they have, you know, the image of Lady Justice with the weights.
Absolutely.
And when people are trusting a common standard and they're believing everyone else is recognizing this, it helps us navigate relationships and conflicts, and it keeps us basically all on the same page and makes living in a society possible. Because without it, what do you have? You really don't know where to go and what to do and how to identify, really the truth within conflict. You'll never be able to do that because, you know, everything is so subjective if there's no standard, right?
Right. And the interesting thing is when you go and look back at the Old Testament, there were obviously laws against stealing and that kind of thing. And one of the laws was when one person steals from another directly, he has to repay his victim for that loss incurred. But if he takes something without the other's knowledge, a deception, this thought process of really taking it and you don't know about it, he was required to pay double instead of just what he had stolen. And usually, you know, taking something directly, there's intimidation factor involved and whatnot. And you would think that would be a greater crime, that you're physically stealing from somebody. But the reality is, and it's explained by one of these ancient rabbis, that when you really look at it, the theft is a terrible crime because you are taking something that doesn't belong to you. Yet stealing through deception is ultimately worse because the deceit creates a false reality. And I think that's kind of what you're pointing out. And other people can get snared into that same false reality. And when you look for the truth, you expose these deceptions and stuff, you're not only helping yourself, but you're also rescuing others. And he says, when the thief is caught and his deception is revealed, he pays double because not only must he pay for the original theft to be recovered, but also all the other collateral damage that's caused by that deception. And I think that's really what we're kind of point out, there's a lot of collateral damage and impact by having that unequal weight, that deception.
And I don't think this is overstating it at all. I think what you really do in the big picture, again, is that you just undermine all knowledge and wisdom and received understanding, because basically, if you can't properly tell the difference between things, there's no such thing as logic. And now, you know what? Somebody that I've learned to like over the years is Aristotle. Aristotle's the father of logic. And it was introduced to me a few years back by, you know, a simple book called Aristotle for Everybody. And then I've had a class. But, you know, he taught that logic is the ability to ask good questions and to properly classify things. If you cannot properly classify things and you cannot ask the proper questions, which are two elements we'll talk a little bit later that political correctness is absolutely undermining, those two realities, then your basis for knowledge and understanding, and that understanding is so fundamental for people, again, the social compact, people to interact with each other and have confidence in their interactions, that a society can be sustained. And you're talking about, that's why proper weights were everything. An economy would literally collapse, you know, in an ancient city state or part of the ancient world if their scales were off. It could not be sustained unless they had that, this is this and that is that. This weighs this and that weighs that. And if we can't agree on that, then nothing is real after that. You know?
And that was one of the techniques that the Nazis actually used during World War II, was they counterfeited, basically in today's dollars, around $1 billion worth of British notes in order to try and bring down the economies of the Allied forces and, at the same time, basically fund the Nazi war machine. They did it through counterfeiting, this unequal weight of creating false notes.
Yeah, and that, you know, again, it just creates such chaos not to be able to tell which is which and what is what. And if you really do want to bring down, in which they were aiming at, bringing down the British economy and you know, the whole country, really, there's no better way to do that than to remove those differences where you can't tell the difference anymore and everything means is the same. Because if everything means is the same, then everything is it has no real true meaning to it, right?
Right.
It's nothing. There's no distinction. You can't tell.
And along the lines of Aristotle, he made the statement that it is unjust to treat unequal things equally. And I think that's really this,
yeah,
what we're trying to get at here is it, when you have weights that are not equal and you try and treat them equal, you're creating an unjust situation.
Yeah, you're just as unjust as if you're discriminating between,
exactly,
two equals.
And that's kind of what brought this discussion up, was there's an article out there from the Daily Beast about a college where the whole concept of what Martin Luther King was doing is being considered a problem. And
I mean, this is an astonishing story. And you would think that this kind of thing would have been dismissed early for just being out, you know, just being ridiculous.
Foolishness, as Solomon would like to say, total foolishness.
But then we're talking about the University of Oregon.
Yeah, and so the issue here is that they were considering removing Martin Luther King's quote, "I have a dream," from a wall of a campus building. Why? Because the famous statement only references one kind of diversity, skin color, and is therefore not inclusive. This was the opinion of at least one student that wrote to the campus newspaper. And this young lady, Mia Ashley, she's a sophomore architect student who wasn't on the board, says, "Diversity is so much more than race. Obviously, race still plays a big role, but there are people who identify differently in gender, and this is the part I like, all sorts of things like that," Ashley said. Now, I'm sure Ashley's got some level of education. She's a sophomore there, but...
Yeah, absolutely.
But in order to really...
It's a good thing their mascot is the duck, because she's a quack.
And I think that's that when you look at this and the fact that she's trying to take and equate what Martin Luther King was doing and the fight against a real social injustice with
historical precedent and, you know, just, I mean, she's basically trying to say that discrimination against the color of your skin is equal to the other forms of less apparent forms of discrimination. Let's put it that way. Your skin color, which is not only immutable, it doesn't change, right. And it's apparent. Right. So
your physical characteristics, like the physical measurements, they're immutable.
Exactly. They cannot change, and they're apparent. They're always apparent. So I'm not saying there are not other forms of discrimination and that people haven't suffered unjustly.
Well, there's always the case of Michael Jackson.
Yeah, there's always Michael. But well, we know
his new nose kind of gave him away.
Does discrimination have to be physical, though, for it still to happen?
Well, this is exactly what we're talking about. The difference between skin color is that it's apparent and it's immutable, meaning that no matter what you do, you'll never be able to change that factor. So let's talk about other kinds of discrimination. You know, it could be men, it could be religious, it could be sexual orientation, whatever. If you were in dire straits and in desperate need, you could subjugate that, right?
You could change. You could change your choice.
You could call yourself Bill Smith, and you can go somewhere, and you could, it doesn't matter what country you're from, your parents could be Serbians, doesn't matter. Well, you could adjust.
Wouldn't that
be with skin color, you can't do that.
Be discrimination because you have to change who you are to survive where you are? Aren't you?
You can't change your physical being.
Well, that would be a reaction to discrimination. I mean, but you could literally survive until you can get your bearings and go somewhere else or lead a revolution or something. But we're talking, you could eat that day. But we're talking about something where you don't have any other choice but to face that reality. And I don't think they're equal. We're not saying the other one doesn't matter. We're saying they're not equal.
All right. We'll be right back with more of Following My Bias.
Good question, Jackson. Lies, la, 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 la.
You kicked me when I was down, and they hurt me, all those lies, lies, la 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 lies.
07456. We want to hear what you have to say.
Hello?
Power Talk 1210.
All right, we're back. Quick break there. A little bit of music for us. And I think we need to go back to Jackson's question and what he was trying to ask with regards to the aspect of discrimination. It is something that exists. There is discrimination. And you made that statement, Fred, that it's not like it doesn't happen for different aspects of people's lives. But there is not an equal weight when it comes to somebody's physical characteristics that they're being discriminated for and somebody's personal life choices that they're being discriminated for, because those are a personal life choice.
Or secondary characteristics.
Or secondary characteristics that cannot be seen, that could be hidden completely, and you wouldn't be discriminated against because people cannot see them.
Talk about skin color, right? And then the mass immigration of like 1900, you know, Ellis Island era of immigration. So a lot of people came into this country from Eastern Europe, from Southern Europe, and they had all the same disadvantages to begin with economically. Education-wise, they didn't have many connections.
They all came very, very poor.
Very poor and oftentimes diseased, and they'd have to be, you know,
isolated
for a while, and then they'd let them in, and then they were walking the streets of, the east side of Manhattan lost.
Right. I read a book this summer when we were in Cape Cod about the whole Ellis Island thing, and it was just, I'd never really delved into it, and it was just incredible, the number of people and how poor these people were when they came through. They had absolutely nothing.
You know, all the people that came from the Russian Pales, they call it, they're like reservations for, mm-hmm. I mean, this is horrible. I mean, they had not but been
from the famines. These the people
they were starving. Yes. They had no access to education, medical care. So here they were in this country with all these enormous social disadvantages. But the one advantage they had was the color of their skin, plain and simple. And so you could come to America with a five-syllable Eastern European name, and like I said a moment ago, you can change your name to Bill Smith. And once you learn how to speak English, and particularly your children learned how to speak English, suddenly the playing field just leveled out, right?
That was how they integrated into the country.
And you assimilated, and there's nothing wrong with assimilating. Makes a lot of sense, especially in that context. And so suddenly you're in. But if you are if you were African American and you have you know what you would be an average kind of black dark skin, it doesn't matter what you know. There's plenty of African Americans named Bill Smith too, but that didn't make a difference for them.
Right.
And this was an apparent immutability. There's nothing you're going to do about this. So all I'm saying is, and I think you're saying the same thing, is that these two kinds of discrimination are not equal. There could have been people in New York City who said, oh no, man, here comes one of those guys from Italy or from, you know, whatever, Eastern Europe. I hate Eastern Europeans. I hate Blintzes. I hate, you know, yeah, sure. I'm sure people felt that kind of discrimination and, you know, resistance. But the bottom line is they could adjust to survive it in other ways. But if someone says that about the color of a person's skin, there's nothing you're going to do. It's always going to be an issue, and it will always be a factor until that particular issue is settled.
Right.
I mean, and so what I'm saying is they're not equal. So this girl at the University of Oregon and the people even carrying a conversation about this shows you how deluded they are. Remember we were talking about deception?
Yes.
And how they're undermining every basis of common sense now in society because they cannot tell the difference. They cannot properly categorize these things. And they're doing a horrendous disservice to.
I have a question.
Sure.
What if she's blind?
Well, then there you go. Mia's blind.
Okay.
What if she is blind?
What's
discrimination to her then? Because there are some people that are blind, right? How do they experience?
Well,
what is it really?
Well, what blind people have is Braille, and you have, and I'm making my point here. You have service dogs, and you also have people in your life who you relate to culturally, right? And those people probably give you lots of information that you don't get on your own. Now, I would agree with you. I would believe that a blind person, it'd be an interesting study to find out how less likely they are to, you know, embrace that kind of discrimination.
Or more likely.
Yeah. So it'd be very personality and culture based at that point. And then you would go to the secondary characteristics. So that would be an anomaly. What we're talking about is how people relate, you know. Who don't have those kinds of disadvantages, which is mostly everybody. So I think when you do have eyes, then you can see, and a person's culture and all of those things, they may be factors, but they're not the last word. Like skin color is the last word. That's what I'm saying.
And to some extent, she is blind because she isn't looking at the real balance of justice here, right? What is truth and what isn't? And what has a weight to it that's greater than the other. She is blind to the fact that there is a difference. And so she has this deception going on in herself that she doesn't really see the impact of and the weight of what somebody that really is being discriminated against and can't have any way of overcoming it versus the things that she, as she says, all sorts of things like that. And reality, it's really boiling down to how you identify from a gender perspective.
That's what did she say exactly again? I already forgot.
It says, diversity is so much more than race. Obviously, race still plays a big role, but there are people who identify differently in gender and all sorts of things like that. And so for her view is that Martin Luther King's little bit of focus on purely a race aspect doesn't qualify him to have a quote up there on their student union or building that says, I have a dream.
She said that?
Well, that's what she's fighting against. They were fighting to not have that quote put back up on the building. They're doing some remodeling. And the discussion was, should that be up on the building? Huh. And the approach is, no, because it's not inclusive enough.
Now, I think what we need to bring out clearly here is that Martin Luther King identified with his life and purpose one of the greatest ills in American history, which was, African slavery and the ensuing racial discrimination that came out of it. And this girl's not only blind to some of the obvious issues, she's blind to history. I mean, we're talking about something that it caused and I know there are other factors in states' rights and all that, but it really was right in the center of the Civil War conflict, because that's what separated the South from the North, was that some were free states and some were slave states. It changed all of their economies and all that. So all these other political factors were in play, but it was still about African slavery at the end of the day. And that's why I believe it came down to the proclamation that Lincoln gave, abolishing slavery.
Right. And I think that's the second half of what Solomon is talking about. He says the unequal weights are an abomination, but he also says that dishonest scales are not good.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's the scale parts. The dishonest weights are kind of like the law. You can't have unequal laws, but the scale parts are like the justice system, right? The application of those laws and having dishonest scales where one group of people is given one set of preferences over another, that really is the balance of scales is really the whole basis for our government, a system of checks and balances amongst the different branches of the government. Well, that same balance has to be applied to the laws that are out there for people. And that's really what
right, and to make
my, he was fighting for.
In further defense of Martin Luther King Jr., he took on the more important aspect of discrimination. And that's what I make very clearly. The reason he should be a civil rights hero, not just civil rights, an American hero for the ages, is because he took on the greater problem, the more important problem, the more apparent problem, and the problem that had caused more destruction and division in America than these other problems. They're not equal. They're simply not equal.
Well, they're a smaller group of people, aren't they?
In terms of
how many transgender or whatnot people are out there that are being discriminated.
But the numbers proportionally different. I'm not saying other forms of discrimination don't exist. I'm saying other forms of discrimination do not equal someone being discriminated against because of the color of their skin.
Wouldn't the goal to be eliminate as much discrimination as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think if you take on the one that is most important, that I think the others will tend to fall in line to that. Because once you take on the hardest challenge, all the other challenges will kind of find their place. But one thing is for sure, you treat everything equally and they're not equal, then you're going to cause confusion and deception in society and culture, and logic goes out the window.
Yeah, and I like the book The Law. Frederick Bastiat is kind of one of my favorite authors when it comes to really understanding how society should work. And when you have these dishonest scales, what he calls it is legal plunder. And it's the same thing. It's a counterfeiting. And his comment in his book, he says, how is legal plunder to be identified? Quite simply, see if the law takes from some person what belongs to them and gives it to other persons to whom it does not belong. See if the law benefits one citizen at the expense of another by doing what the citizen himself cannot do without committing a crime. And I think that's kind of the basis for what we're seeing here. There is legal dishonesty going on with respect to the civil rights aspect of it, and had been. And he actually pointed out, he was writing probably right around 1850, so before the American Civil War, and he pointed out two areas in the United States where he saw this system of justice being used in a dishonest manner. And he pointed out that they were slavery and tariffs. And these are the only two issues, he said, where, contrary to the general spirit of the Republic of the United States, law has assumed the character of a plunderer. So to him, slavery is a violation by law of liberty. And he said the protective tariff is a violation of law by property. And if you really look at the history of the Civil War, those were the two main issues of the Civil War, tariffs and slavery. And so he said it's kind of remarkable that he was seeing the future of what the Civil War was going to be before it ever occurred in this country.
Well, you know, and just kind of extrapolating from all of that going forward, you know, the civil rights movement, when it lost sight of what really mattered the most, I think became not only ineffective, but it actually stole something very important, downright organic to the African-American people in the United States. Since the 1960s, when Dr. King had been doing his thing through the 50s into the 60s, but when everyone else jumped on board and what I call the Me Too cause, Me Too, you know, he's addressing, I think, the real, in my opinion, the most serious aspect of discrimination in this country was racism. When he's addressing that for what, and I mean in particular skin color.
Right.
And so when he's addressing this, and then everyone saw the success of that and how well he was able to use peaceful demonstration, then the Me Too's jumped on. Everybody's cause in their minds was just as equal to that, and it was not. And I don't apologize that for that. I think Dr. King, and we'll talk about this when we come back, if I can say in my humble place made any mistake at all, was the day he gave the best speech, the one that they're trying to challenge here, was he called that the Poor People's March on Washington. And I think that was probably the decision that set the trajectory away from
the cause
of the African-American people. And it should have stayed there, in my opinion. And I think all other civil rights causes would have benefited more from having the most important one continuously chipped away at, which is do not discriminate against people for the color of their skin.
All right, we'll be right back with more Solomon on Blast.
A long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
All right, we're back with Solomon on Blast. Rather than some music, we just wanted to go right into somebody that really had the view of what was going on in that time frame. This is a debate between William F. Buckley and James Baldwin in 1965 at Cambridge. If you want to cue that up for us, Jackson.
Or murder, leaving aside the bloody catalog of oppression, which we are in one way too familiar with already, what this does to the subjugated, the most private, the most serious thing this does to the subjugated, is to destroy his sense of reality. It destroys, for example, his father's authority over him. His father can no longer tell him anything because the past has disappeared. And his father has no power in the world. This means, in the case of an American Negro, born in that glittering republic, and in the moment you are born, since you don't know any better, every stick and stone and every face is white, and since you have not yet seen a mirror, you suppose that you are too. It comes as a great shock, around the age of 5 or 6 or 7, to discover that the flag to which you have pledged allegiance, along with everybody else, has not pledged allegiance to you. It comes as a great shock to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians, when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you. It comes as a great shock to discover that the country, which is your birthplace, and to which you owe your life and your identity, has not in its whole system of reality evolved any place for you. The disaffection, the demoralization, and the gap between one person and another, only on the basis of the color of their skins, begins there and accelerates throughout a whole lifetime. So the present you realize you're 30. and are having a terrible time managing to trust your countrymen. By the time you are 30, you have been through a certain kind of mill. And the most serious effect of the mill you've been through is, again, not the catalog of disaster. The policemen, the taxi drivers, the waiters, the landlady, the landlord, the banks, the insurance companies, the millions of details, 24 hours of every day, which spell out to you that you are a worthless human being. It is not that. It's by that time you've begun to see it happening in your daughter or your son or your niece or your nephew. You are 30 by now, and nothing you have done has helped you to escape the trap. But what is worse than that is that nothing you have done, and as far as you can tell, nothing you can do, will save your son or your daughter from meeting the same disaster and not impossibly coming to the same end.
I mean, that's, you know, that's very difficult to hear because the reality behind it is so deep. And even though they were discussing some other issue there at that particular debate, to me, once he began to articulate the way he did about what it was really like to have to live at that time, you know, America was a different place, but in a culture where your skin color was so, was such an acute factor. It's just hard to hear because until you feel that kind of pain, I don't think you even know what he's talking about. And so our point is very much this. Don't call everything that, because that's a different level of pain and it's a different level of discrimination. And I understand there are other forms of it, but it's not that. It's not that. And people need to be very honest about that. And let me just say one other thing here before we move on. He made a statement there, which is very pro. He made a couple, more than one, but one that I want to lock onto. James Baldwin said, after he gives this incredible refrain of all these different challenges, he says, only on the basis of the color of their skin.
Only one factor.
In other words, he said, this was the real factor. Not all the other different personality traits or preferences or even whatever you want to call them. He said only on the basis of the color of their skin. And that was really the real factor. So don't call those other factors, Mia, in Oregon, same, equal. It's not equal.
I think Mia should take the time to actually watch this debate and understand the real question. Because they were kind of debating the aspect of whether blacks in America or America's prosperity was done on the backs of blacks, and that was kind of the whole premise for the debate. But there's so much more in this. It really shows you what a debate is. These debates with the presidential candidates are a joke when you compare it to something like this, where there was a true debate, a platform, a discussion. You could never get through something like this in today's society. And the one aspect of it that William F. Buckley brings out is he says, what are you to do with regards to these kind of injustices? He really asks the question, okay, if these exist, how are you going to resolve it? And the thing that he brought forward was that those that are most affected by it are the ones that are going to be able to do the best job of helping to resolve it. And I think that's what Martin Luther King was doing. And I don't think Mia's got any clue as to what's going on with regards to what she's trying to promote. And there's no way she's going to do the best job of resolving her little issues and her thought process associated with whether or not they should allow something like this. I have a dream to be posted up on those buildings.
Yeah, having a lip ring is just not the same feeling, you know, as being a black man in the 1950s.
This is Jake Feinberg.
Hello, Jake.
Hi, guys. Jake. I don't know why you guys both look so good. For the radio audience, you guys are really looking dapper today. Just for the radio, you're not going anywhere special?
Yeah, we are, actually.
You are, right?
Yeah.
All right, I want to be very clear. I just read a story out of Boston, guy that worked for the Massachusetts Institute for Art, black man, returning from lunch. It's a long, long story, but it speaks to the mistrust in this country, because he was detained by about a dozen cops because he, quote unquote, fit a description of somebody breaking into a woman's house. He had his teaching lanyard on. He had a knitted cap on that was completely unique. I just don't think we should be Pollyannish about the fact that there is deep-seated mistrust amongst black people. We can't possibly pretend to know. He was scared for his life. They were ready to put him in a cop car because he fit a description. He was on his lunch break, and they harangued him for
I agree with you, Jake, and that's kind of the whole point of this discussion, is that when you have
You agree. No, I'm not talking about because what I'm trying to say is there are. I guess here's the question, guys.
There's
how many white people in this country could not admit to their social circle that they voted for Barack Obama? He won handily over Mitt Romney. What I'm saying is, there's plenty of white cats that are voting for Barack Obama. They can't tell their friends that. Meaning, I don't want to personalize it to you two, but there's a lot of deep-seated mistrust based on cultural bias in this country, period. He won handily. And there are many people that could never admit to their people in their social circles or the people they go to worship with that they voted for him. I just want to make that clear.
Well, here's the paradox that we're pointing out, is that it's the people who are now, quote-unquote, supporting every cause of diversity that are now undermining the very civil rights accomplishments
that
are
going to
help
made.
That guy. In other words, we're saying this little girl in Oregon can't tell the difference between this guy's plight and her own little personal head trip, you know, little white girl. So that's our point. Even though they're saying they're all about diversity and civil rights, in reality, they are hijacking the true civil rights cause, which was to help African-American people in particular, but dark-skinned people in general, right, find their way in this country. And so it's the very people who claim to be their most ardent supporters, I would even say she's not old enough probably, would have voted for Barack Obama, that are actually undermining the civil rights movement that guarantees this man's rights.
Go ahead.
So the whole point here is, how do you really resolve this issue? And I think you have to get back to the fact that justice has to be done properly. There has to be a just decision process. And Solomon talks about it. He says in Proverbs 29, many seek the ruler's favor. Everybody's looking for the government to go solve the problem. But, he says, justice for man comes from the Lord. And that's the real solution to the problem, because it has to be the one that gives the law that provides the right justice for the law and for our country, and what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks, the law and everything. That law comes from God, the commandments of God, and that's where you have to go back to look for justice. Ultimately, justice is only going to come from the real lawgiver, not from the government and whatever else that we're trying to get it from, because ultimately, it's the balance scale, the proper balance, is only going to show up when the one who instituted the law invokes that justice. And I'd have to say, you know, the ultimate balance scale that we have to look at is our sin and Christ's sacrifice. And that really is it, because in Matthew 12:18, it says, Jesus, he will declare justice for the Gentiles. That's where we're looking for our justice. Until next week, keep thinking wisely.